Welcome to What's for Dinner, a radio show about food, cooking, and eating, and sharing favorite recipes from Petersburg, Alaska, and around the world. Brought to you by KFSK Community Supported Radio in Petersburg, Alaska. I'm your host, Mindy Anderson. Good afternoon. Coming up on What's for Dinner today, Sunday dinner, also the drink of the week, and my sweet tooth. That's all coming up this afternoon in just a few minutes on What's for Dinner. Support for What's for Dinner on KFSK comes from Hammer & Wecon Grocery Store, offering an expanded organic produce selection, cheeses, meats, Italian breads, and special occasion cheesecake and birthday cakes in the deli. In the meat department, Duane's Famous Sausages, with staff happy to make those special cuts. Delivery and van service available, Hammer & Wecon, a Petersburg family-owned business since 1921. Welcome to What's for Dinner. I'm your host, Mindy Anderson. I'm not a chef. I just love to cook. And sometimes, I admit, I'll cook real flops. And recently, well, pizza last night, but I have been doing some cooking the last week, which is nice, eating some leftovers, made some large batches of different things. And thanks to some friends, we have fresh fish and all that good stuff. We just love being friends with fishermen. So thank you. Made a fettuccine with roasted garlic and tomatoes and roasted garlic scapes. Also Parmesan breadcrumbs. And then some fresh, well, halibut and salmon. And something to please everybody in the family, but I wanted a sauce to go with either one that would go well with either one. So this is the sauce, and I just came up with this one. This is a simple mustard scape sauce for fish because it is garlic scape season. And a simple mustard scape sauce for fish. It was delicious. Super great on halibut, super great on fish or on salmon. So I'm going to give you that recipe. And also coming up today, we're going to talk about paella. It's one of my favorite dishes, and if it's on a menu, I'm definitely ordering it. And we're going to talk about that today. But first, let's get to the fettuccine. I love Pappardelle's pasta. That's the pasta place you can shop at when you're down at Place Market. But trust me, it's really busy this time of the year. It's June. Don't go on a weekend if you can avoid it. There's so many people everywhere. I always feel sorry for the kids in strollers because all they get to do is just like see thousands and thousands of people at their level. And it's just so busy in there. You're best walking out on the street to get from one place to another rather than going in the market if you know what you want. But I knew exactly what I wanted. I needed to make a stop at Pappardelle's to pick up some pasta, and I bought a parsley lemon fettuccine and brought that home to cook it. So also some scapes, garlic scapes, and remember they're off the garlic, and They're very garlicky, but yet kind of chivey too, and they're green. Eating them raw, they're super pungent and spicy. But once you cook them, they become a lot milder. And I would suggest that, or you can pickle them, you can roast them, you can turn them into pasta or pesto. I think last year I did a whole show just about scapes. But so I got some water boiling on the stove, added some sea salt to it, so it had a nice sea salt flavor to the water, because that goes right into your fettuccine. And then on a roasting pan, I use parchment underneath. I put maybe 15 scapes. You want to chop off the very, very thin ends of the scapes. So they'll kind of wind around, and then you have like the little, you have the flower that would open. It's kind of a bulb at the top, and then it gets very, very narrow and thin, and that gets kind of like, it's hard to chew on. It's like you're eating something, it just, you know, and it's stringy. So chop that off. I've learned from experience to just chop some of that off so you don't have that stringiness you're trying to deal with going down your throat. And then also tomatoes. If you want to splurge, the little grape tomatoes or the little tomatoes on the vine, to just roast those, they're incredible. But any of the smaller tomatoes that you can get in the grocery stores are fine for this. Take the scapes and the tomatoes, mix them with a little bit of sea salt and some olive oil, and spread them out onto a roasting pan on the parchment. And then you can just put those in the oven and roast them for, well, until you know that tomatoes are a little bit bubbly and soft, and the scapes are nice and soft too, with a little bit of browned, and they kind of shrivel up just a little bit. And then I want to let you know, I forgot to mention, I just blanched the scapes for a few minutes before I put them onto the baking sheet and mixed them with oil. I had the water going anyway for the fettuccine, so I threw the scapes in for like 30 seconds, pulled them back out, and plunged them into some cold water. I didn't even bother using ice with the water, because our water here is so cold. Plunged them into a sink full of cold water so they'd stop cooking that way, and then dried them with a paper towel, and then put them on with the tomatoes. So you might want to blanch them just for a little bit, and you could probably get away with not blanching them, but I had the water right there. So you have your scapes and your tomatoes on your parchment on a baking sheet. When I decided to do the fettuccine, I threw some garlic in ahead of time into just a little dish, some garlic cloves mixed with a little olive oil, and I threw those in and let those cook up and get nice and soft. And what you want to do with those is mash them up and then mix them with your pasta. So nice and creamy garlic paste with a little bit of salt and some olive oil. You're going to just make like this garlic mash. So there you go. Also, I threw in some extra garlic cloves onto the parchment with the scapes and the tomatoes so they would roast as well. So lots of roasting happening, but it really doesn't take that much work. It really doesn't. And go ahead and cook your fettuccine then. And when it's al dente, you can take it off the hot water, set it aside in a colander, and rinse out your pan or throw your hot water down the sink. And then I throw a little bit of olive oil into the pan with the roasted garlic. Make sure it's all mashed up. Put the fettuccine in with that. Use your tongs, mix it up a little bit. From there, I add the tomatoes and the scapes. The nice thing about the scapes is they're nice and long, and they just kind of mix up with the fettuccine. They're nice and limp. And so you mix all those up together, toss them with the tongs, throw in a little more olive oil, some Parmesan cheese, and you're set. And if you really want to have a bang-up dish, some breadcrumbs, a little freshly grated Parmesan and a little bit of butter. You can make a little crumble with that and put it in the oven right after the tomatoes and scapes have browned. You can throw in the crumble and let it brown just a little bit. You can do this ahead of time too. And then you can sprinkle that onto the pasta and kind of toss it in. And you've got these little crunchy, Parmesan-y, buttery bread bits too. Very delicious. And serve it alongside a nice salad of your choice. The tomatoes just kind of pop, but yeah, they're a little bit roasted, so they're a little more intense. And that garlic is the roasted garlic paste. It's not so intense and garlicky. It has some of a sweetness to it. And then, of course, that fettuccine is delicious. It's a lemon parsley. And sometimes you can get that here in town. But if not, just, you know, you could even use like a spinach fettuccine or just a plain fettuccine or whole wheat if you want or whatever you use for your pasta dishes will be delicious. This dish would go really well with fish. Like if you just wanted to serve a little bit of pasta with some fish on the side with this mustard scape sauce, it would go really, really well together. So the mustard scape sauce, I had to type it up so I wouldn't give you the wrong thing. I really wanted something the other night. I was making fish and I wanted something that was kind of like a hollandaise sauce but wasn't. And so and I didn't want to go to the grocery store. I had scapes, I had onion, I had garlic, I had stone ground mustard, and I had this fish. I'm like, well, this is it then. This is what I'm making. I turned on my saute pan to medium heat and added a stick of salted butter because you know that hollandaise sauce uses butter. And then let the butter melt, and I added chopped scapes, probably about a cup of diced garlic scapes, and then also a half of a white onion, and I sauteed those until they were soft, about 10 minutes. Then I added a clove or two of chopped garlic. I can't remember if it was a clove or two, so it's up to you. You don't want it to be too garlicky. The scapes are already pretty garlic enough, but so I think I just used one clove probably. Saute the garlic in there after you've chopped it up, then remove it from the heat and let it cool for about 5 minutes because you're going to put it into the blender. Remember, you don't want to put anything super hot off the stove into your blender because you don't want it to explode. And let it cool for about 5 minutes. And then pour that into your blender or your food processor. And then you're going to add a tablespoon or a spoonful of stone ground mustard. We use Boji's from Rock Island. It's delicious. You can find some mustard similar to it in town. If it looks stone ground, it's probably pretty good. A juice from one lemon. And about a quarter cup of olive oil. And then you're going to blend that until nice and smooth. And you're going to have a pretty smooth looking sauce in there. And blending it is going to cool it down a little bit too. And then, of course, for the very creamy, rich hollandaise effect, we're going to add in the egg yolks. So add 2 egg yolks to that. Blend it again. And it's going to be this nice, beautiful, yellow, creamy, delicious sauce. And no, it is not low fat, but it is so good. And don't forget to add some sea salt and ground pepper. You'll want to start off adding it when you add everything to the butter. And just test it because you're using salted butter anyway. But this is so good. This, you could like put a little dollop on each piece of fish, or I just smeared a little bit on the plate and then put the fish on top. And it was great. I loved it. I tried it with the salmon and I tried it with the halibut, and I made sure that my salmon had super crispy skin. And I actually served the salmon with the crispy skin side up, which I normally don't do, but I was just so excited to be in my kitchen cooking that I just did the crispy skin job on the salmon, and it was so good with this sauce. And so that's the mustard scape sauce. I did type this up, so it's easy for me to email it to you if you want it. Just email mindy@kfsk.org and make sure you put my name on it. Okay. And that's pretty much it. I also made some paella, which led to today's topic, paella, one of my favorite dishes. And like I said, if it's on the menu, I'm going to order it. And if there was paella or risotto, I would probably order the paella. And that's coming up next on What's for Dinner. What's for Dinner comes from Inga's Galley, open for business 11 a.m. to 8 p.m., serving locally grown food and fresh-caught seafood, including sandwiches, curries, kebabs, salads, and sides. And the Manwich, quarter-pound burger on a Kaiser roll with bacon, egg, and cheese. 4th of July specials coming up. Inga's Galley with heated outdoor seating downtown, beer and wine available. 772-2090. Welcome back to What's for Dinner. I'm Mindy Anderson, your host. Recently, I've begun my quest to make a great paella. So I ordered special Kalispara rice, some new spices like saffron and smoked paprika. And then this new awesome 36-inch paella pan. And this pan will feed 40 to 50 people. So I'm really excited to get it out and actually make a huge batch of paella for the first time. So the last week or so, I've been experimenting with a recipe and ingredients, and I've been doing a lot of research on just how I want to go about it and making some paella at home. So just a little bit of a background. The earliest kind of paella, and by the way, paella is named after the wide, shallow steel pan in which you cook that rice dish. And so the earliest kinds were produced with local ingredients, of course, like every, you know, what they had there, and then local eating habits. And real Spanish paella, or Valencia-style paella, originated in Valencia. And it's a little bit darker, it's a little richer, smokier, and denser than pilaf, and a little drier than risotto. And lots of people say it's more satisfying. So a little bit darker and richer and denser, not like just the yellow, light, fluffy paella that you might see a lot of times in restaurants, if you've ever had paella. I have never been to Spain, so I'm not an expert, but I have had different paellas. And I know, now that I've done a lot of research about it, paella exists because of the rice, number one. And the rice, it existed in Valencia ever since the Moors planted it there in more than 1,300 years ago, and it's still grown today. The saffron brought to Spain by Arab traders which a lot of paellas have saffron in it. A lot of Arab traders in the 10th century, it was the preferred seasoning. And it does remain in many traditional paellas, but not all of them. Also, local game like rabbit, forage foods like snails, also legumes and vegetables. And all of those were introduced to the rice dishes during the Moorish occupation of Spain. But pork was prohibited under Muslim dietary laws, and shellfish were not in those original paellas. So after the Moors left Spain in 1492, the Valencians' love for rice dishes lived on, and then they started coming up with many recipes for paella. And the first printed version of paella from Valencia appeared in 1840, and it was rabbit, snail, bean, saffron. So there you go. We know some people here who raise rabbits for food, and I might have to try it. I am so interested in all these different paellas that I've been reading about. I'm so interested because, you know, it could be a dish. It's just what's in your refrigerator or freezer. You're trying to clean something out of the freezer. You could use all sorts of meats and seafoods. And we're so lucky because we have a lot of that here that we catch ourselves or hunt for. And then, of course, rice is not that expensive. You can spend a lot of money on rice, or you can spend just a little, and a little goes a long way. So all paellas start with a sofrito. It's a flavor base. It's chopped vegetables cooked in oil, typically with garlic and tomatoes, also onions and Spanish red peppers. And the longer the sofrito cooks, the darker and more intense the flavor of the paella will be. And I know that from experience. And I always mention on What's for Dinner, too, when you're adding like a tomato paste to some of your dishes, that you let it caramelize. And the reason that the sofrito is getting dark is from all the caramelization of the onions, the garlic, and the tomatoes that you've mixed together. The longer you cook it, the more flavorful it's going to get. It's going to get a little bit sweeter. It's going to get a little bit darker. And it's super important when you're making paella. And also, once you've stirred the rice with the cooked sofrito, and then you've added stock, you do need to leave it alone. So unlike when we're talking about making other rice dishes, you might want to keep stirring. For this one, you're going to not stir at all, and you're going to leave it uncovered so the moisture boils out and goes into the rice, and you actually want that coating on the bottom of your pan, and you want the rice to become nice and crunchy and dark and delicious. So once the rice is cooked through after about 20 minutes, sometimes cooks or people who are cooking the paella will give it a blast of heat to create that crust. And that's what I did recently, and it turned out great. And that little flavorful crust is called the socarrat, and that's what that crusty rice stuff is called on the bottom of your pan. And you want everybody to have a little bit of that. Spaniards use bomba rice, and a lot of people who like to cook paella, they use bomba rice, and these are short grain rice varieties grown near a village of Calasparra. And that's that short grain rice is a little short and fat, and it absorbs a lot of water, like 1.5 times as much water as regular rice, without turning mushy. So if you're going to just try this with your plain old white rice, it's not going to be as good. If you can't find paella rice, which you can here in town, but if you find it's too expensive or you just want to use what you have, maybe you make some sushi. You know, that's a shorter, fatter rice, but you definitely want a short, fatter rice. And, you know, it's just not going to be the same if you're using, like, definitely don't use basmati rice. Okay. Also, saffron, you can use it or not use it. It adds nice yellow color, but really, if you just want to add color to your dish, no use spending a lot of money on saffron when you can just do that with, like, turmeric. And turmeric adds color without adding a whole lot of flavor, extra weird flavor to a dish. And, of course, some people prefer to use, like, a little bit of food coloring, which I would never do, to just turn a rice yellow. But, you know, I guess I disagree with some people when they say, oh, the saffron, you're just adding it in for color, and it really doesn't add that much flavor. I totally think it does. You just don't want to add too much. So, you know, a pinch of saffron in a paella dish might cost you $4. So it's up to you. You know, maybe you're on a budget and that $4 just puts it over the edge and you're not going to be able to do it. You know, some people are making it for a dinner party and you're adding shrimp and you're adding maybe crab and you're adding chorizo, and it's already gotten up there to be a kind of a spendy dish anyway. And if you have the saffron in your cupboard, go ahead and use it. Lots of paella recipes out there. There's lots of them with stocked with seafood, others made with vegetables and meats. Some more delicious than others, but I'm sure they're all delicious, and this is just the beginning for me. And tinkering and experimenting, I think, is a must. So when you serve this, if you're making it for a bunch of people, the pan is supposed to be set on the table, or people can come around to where you're cooking the paella, and the diners scoop up their portions with some wooden spoons, making sure to get plenty of pieces of the burnished meat and the vegetables and to scrape some of the chewy, caramelized sakarat from the bottom. And then you start at the perimeter or the outside and you work your way into the middle. And so here you go. Here's the recipe that I'm working on. I'm going to share it. I'm so excited about paella, and I can't wait to try it with the big pan. Right now I'm just using a smaller pan at home. All right, ingredients. Some chicken thighs. So we're going to maybe serve 8 people with this recipe. A couple of chicken thighs and chicken legs. And I actually would like take a huge cleaver and chop those chicken thighs up in half. I mean, you can actually just, you kind of feel the bone there and you move the bone to one side and you just run a knife down there and chop that thing in half. And it's okay for the bone to be in there, but if you want to, you can take the bone off the thigh. And I like to have the skin on. If you're going to go through the trouble of making a paella, keep that skin on for the flavor. And the legs, you can just serve those whole. A little bit of dried oregano, maybe a teaspoon. Also a couple tablespoons of paprika. It's up to you what paprika you want to use. You can use sweet paprika, but I prefer to use smoked Spanish paprika because I want to have that smoky flavor. So it really tastes like you've cooked the whole thing over a wood fire. I like the smokiness, but you could use the sweet too. You also want to use some good sea salt, kosher salt, freshly ground pepper, 1/4 cup of olive oil. Also a sausage. So you could use, if you had a big Spanish chorizo sausage, which we all know, we can't get that here. Dried sausage, it's pretty hard to find. You could use some sort of Portuguese sausage here. There is something that you can use. Just check out the meat departments and see what you can come up with. Don't use bratwurst or like Italian sausage. So don't use a sausage. Stick with something that's a little drier and firmer, like a linguiça. 4 cloves of garlic, crushed. One onion diced, if you can find Spanish onion, great. Also, a 16-ounce can of whole tomatoes, and you want to drain those into a bowl and then just crush them with your hands. You also want to have a cup of rice. And I use, well, like I said, I had ordered some Kalispara rice. I don't know if you can get Kalispara rice in town, but when I ordered my big paella pan, which I knew I couldn't get in town, I just went ahead and ordered some rice with it. And this is a delicious rice. I know you can get some sort of rice in town. You can use like a risotto rice would even work. Also, just a little pinch of saffron threads. Some broth. You're going to need about 3 cups of broth to the 1 cup of rice. And you want that broth to be warm, just like when you're cooking risotto. Your broth could be a mixture of broths. You can have some fish stock in it. You can have some clam juice in it. You can have it just be chicken stock. Or if you would prefer, you could just use water. I always like to use broth. And then shrimp, clams, or mussels. You can use crab legs. You could use chunks of fish. Whatever you want to do here. I would definitely suggest using shrimp for sure in the shell. And then anything else in a shell that you can come up with around here too. Like I said, mussels or clams, if it's okay season and there's not a lot of shellfish poisoning going around or that sort of thing. Also, like I said, crab legs, and you could use chunks of fish. Also, a half a cup of frozen and thawed sweet peas, some fresh parsley for garnish, and then you'll definitely want some lemon wedges for serving. So the first thing you want to do is rinse your chicken pieces and make sure you pat them dry. You can mix some of the dried oregano and the paprika with a little bit of salt and pepper in a small bowl and rub that all over the chicken and let that sit for a few minutes. Then you're going to heat your olive oil in a paella pan, or if you don't have a paella pan, it's a wide, shallow skillet. So wide and shallow. And you're going to heat that over medium heat. Put the chicken in the pan, skin side down, brown it on all sides, and use your tongs to turn. You don't have to cook it all the way through. You just want it to get nice and browned. Then you're going to add the chorizo and continue to cook that until the oil is nice and vibrant red, because it's going to have, you know, that paprika on it from your chicken and everything. And then the red is going to come out of the sausage as well. Remove the chicken and the sausage to a platter, and you can line that with paper towels if you want to soak up some of that oil. Then you're going to return the pan to the stove, lower the heat down to medium, and then you're going to start the sofrito, which immediately smells so delicious. So saute the garlic first and the onion and add the tomatoes. And you're going to cook this until the mixture caramelizes and the flavors really start to meld. Those tomatoes will really start to turn dark. You don't want it so high that everything's going to burn up. You want it, like I said, medium. And if you feel like it's too hot, lower the heat down. Keep stirring and stirring. It's just going to kind of cook into a paste. You want it to kind of cook into a nice paste. Add more salt and pepper if you need to. And then you're going to pour in your rice into this paste, and you're going to start stirring it around. And you're going to coat the grains, the grains are going to start picking up some of that moist paste, and it's still going to all caramelize together. Plus, the grains are going to toast onto this pan. And not a lot of recipes call for it, but this is when I definitely, to add a little bit of flavor, you're going to pour in about 1/4 cup of white wine. And immediately it will bubble up, and that rice will just absorb that liquid and, you know, flavor number 2 added to the rice right there. So you're also going to stir the saffron in at that time. Another thing you can do too is to sprinkle the saffron into the broth. But if you just, you can take a little bit of the hot water and the pinch of saffron and mix it together so that it's like a little teaspoon of saffron water. You can add it that way, or you can just grind it up in your fingers and put that in. But it'll start to really smell immediately as soon as you put it in there. Some people toast the saffron ahead of time. So some people will take that little bit of saffron and they'll wrap it up into a little bitty aluminum foil flat package, like a little envelope, and then they'll put it on their stovetop on a dry pan, and just for, you know, a minute on each side, and that apparently toasts the saffron, so it really will release its juices and crumble nicely and cook nicely in your dish. And I have never done that, but I'll try to remember to. I'm glad I remembered to tell you. So now you have your white wine in there and the rice, and it's still thick, and you're going to pour in the broth. And you're going to add a bay leaf. And then you're just going to make sure that rice is spread out, and you're going to simmer that for about 10 minutes. You're going to move the pan around so the rice cooks evenly and absorbs the liquid. So I just kept going back to my pan every few minutes and kind of rotating it a quarter turn. That way I knew on my stovetop that everything was cooking good. And it was. The whole pan was cooking evenly because I used a cast iron and I knew that whole thing was heating up. You don't want to cover it. And you don't want to stir it. Do not stir it. Let that rice just sit and absorb all that goodness. And then after about 10 or 15 minutes, you can start adding back the meat. So you're going to put your chicken in and your chorizo. I think if you're using a super big pan, like the 36-inch paella pan, you can just take your chicken and chorizo and push it over to the side, and it just stays in there, which is great. Then you're just going to kind of mix it all back in. You can also add your chicken and chorizo before you put in the stock, too, and do it that way, and it's going to cook up just great and release all the fat and juices into the rice. So just make sure you do that, and then let it sit. A good 15 minutes, and then you can add in your rice or your shrimp. So when I made it at home, I added shrimp on the top. I also added, I think I just added shrimp because that's all I had at home. But if you had clam or mussels, you would kind of tuck those in there as well. If you had crab legs, you would push those right into the rice and into the broth, and kind of push those down in. And fish, you could just nestle that in there too, chunks of fish. And let that cook. Scatter some peas on top. Continue to cook for 5 more minutes. And then ideally you want that nice toasted rice bottom. Have that sucker rat on there. And take it off the heat, allow it to rest. If you don't feel like you have that sucker rat on there, you know, if it doesn't seem like it's really toasty, you can take a wooden spoon and scrape the bottom of your pan, and you should feel that there is something that stays, a layer that stays on the pan, and that way you know it's there. If you can get through the rice and feel the bottom of the pan, then you haven't had that crispy layer achieved. So turn up the heat for a few minutes, and then it'll start to stick. Once that's done, take it off the heat and throw some aluminum foil over the top or a lid, and allow the steam then to kind of gently allow that to come off the bottom of the pan. You can garnish it with some parsley, serve it with some lemon wedges, and there you have it, some delicious paella. The good thing about this dish is it's whatever you have. I would have loved to have had some clams or mussels, or I didn't have any crab, but I had lots of shrimp, and I just loaded that paella with shrimp, and it was delicious. You can serve it with some crusty bread and a nice salad. The chicken was tender, had great flavor. The rice was exquisite, and just that little bit of lemon on top. Perfect. And the shrimp, just leave it in the shell. You don't have to take it out of the shell. Wonderful. So I hope that's inspired you. It doesn't take that long. It only takes from beginning to end. You can make a good paella in a half an hour, believe it or not. Doesn't take all day to make it. And if you wanted to, you could go the route with rabbit. You could put some white beans in there. You could add, you can add whatever you want. You can make it more of a Mexican paella and add some cilantro. You could add some jalapenos, peppers, whatever you want to do. So just watch out. Be on the lookout. One of these days I'll be out in the street with my 50-person paella pan giving everybody samples. I hope so. But first I'm gonna make a couple more before I send it out to the world for everybody else to try. Coming up next on What's for Dinner, the drink of the week. Support for What's for Dinner comes from Keto's Cave and Liquor Store in Petersburg, celebrating the 4th of July holiday weekend in the Beer Garden, Saturday through Monday, offering wine, beer, and drinks outside under the canopy with live music and food. Keto's Cave and Liquor Store on Singley Alley. Welcome back to What's for Dinner. Today, the drink of the week, a blackberry whiskey lemonade. This is from a blog called lifesastrawberry.com. And I love blackberries. I really do. I love anything blackberry. And eventually I'm going to grow them here. I want to grow them. I love them so much. I love them in salads, in desserts. I love blackberry, just about anything. Blackberry ice cream is the bomb, I think. So for this blackberry whiskey lemonade, you could delete the whiskey if you want. And it's 7.5 ounces of whiskey. This serves 4 to 5 people, so you can just replace that with something else, ginger ale or something. So for the blackberry simple syrup, which you need for this, 12 ounces of fresh blackberries and a half a cup of sugar. And then for the blackberry whiskey lemonade, you need 7.5 ounces of whiskey, 7.5 ounces of lemon juice, 1 large rosemary sprig, and 6 ounces of the blackberry simple syrup. So first you start with the syrup, put the blackberries and the sugar in a saucepan over medium heat, cook 20 to 30 minutes until the blackberries have softened, and you have a nice thick syrup. Then strain the syrup through a sieve. Make sure to separate the seeds or lumps from the syrup. And then you can discard the leftover pulp, but you can also, you know, freeze the pulp if you want to, like ice cube trays or something, and put it in smoothies. Who cares if it's got seeds? Because you just slam it down. And then let the syrup cool on the counter for about 20 minutes. And you can make it ahead of time, a couple days ahead of time if you want, so that you can have it for your drinks. So for, plus it's such a great syrup, you could put it on ice cream. Probably wouldn't even last for the drinks. If you had kids around, they'd be putting it on ice cream. For the blackberry whiskey lemonade, combine all the ingredients in a large shaker and add a handful or two of ice cubes. And that would be the whiskey, the lemon juice, the rosemary sprig, and the blackberry simple syrup. Depending on your size of shaker, you might have to shake the drinks in two batches. And then shake, shake, shake. Pour over ice into glasses and serve. You can serve it with a little sprig of rosemary. Gives a little kick up the ladder there, just a little touch of gourmet, but so delicious. And like I said, with ginger ale, this would be great. But with whiskey, great. And if you can find a cute little straw, and that's from lifesastrawberry.com. So check it out. And here is my sweet tooth for today. I was wanting to share some recipes with cereal that use cereal in another way than just eating it with milk. And of course, there's lots of recipes out there. So that's for another show, perhaps maybe even the next What's for Dinner. But I could not stop thinking about this recipe that is a Coconut Lover's Rice Krispie Treats. I love coconut. And you can health this up a little bit if you want to. If you're someone who, you know, just uses organic or non-sweetened or, you know, a different kind of, you know, cereal, certainly go for it. You know what to do. So this is the Coconut Lover's Rice Krispie Treats. This is from Mary Yoakum from her blog, Bare Feet Kitchen. This will give you 12 to 18 Rice Krispie Treats. You need 6 tablespoons of butter, 8 cups of miniature marshmallows. That's about 14 ounces if you're just thinking about how much of the bag to throw in. 6 cups of crisp rice cereal, 2 cups of marshmallows for additional add-in. So these aren't going to be mixed with the butter. These are just going to be these chewy little marshmallowy bits in your Rice Krispie treat. And then 1.5 cups of shredded coconut plus an additional 1/4 cup for topping. So maybe you want to use the sweetened coconut, that's fine. And if you don't want to use sweetened, you just want to use unsweetened, I'm sure it's sweet enough without adding sweetened coconut, but these are going to be good either way. Line a large baking sheet or a 9x13 pan with parchment. Set it aside. If you're going to use foil, that's fine, but don't forget to grease it. There's nothing worse than trying to peel off something like this and then like little strips and shards of foil sticking to it. Parchment isn't that expensive, and it can last you a long time, so sometimes you can reuse it. Try the parchment. Otherwise, you're going to have to grease the foil. Melt the butter in a large pot over medium heat. Add your 8 cups of marshmallows or your 14 ounces of marshmallows and stir until they're melted. Remove that from the heat. Add your cereal, and you're going to stir in the additional marshmallows and then the coconut. Scoop the sticky cereal mixture into the lined pan. Use a lightly buttered spatula or spoon and gently press the mixture across the pan, being careful not to press too firmly. Let that cool for a few minutes before slicing. And you can store it in an airtight container for several days. If you want to figure out how to put more coconutty goodness into that, you can. But I can't wait to make these. They sound so good. I'm going to have to make them and like give a bunch of them away, take them here to the radio station or somewhere so that I'm only limited to one or two. And Mary has a cook's note here. There are a couple things to keep in mind in order to achieve the perfect Rice Krispie treat. Don't press too hard when you're spreading them into the pan. Press as lightly as you can in order to spread them out. If you press them down too much, they'll wind up with a very firm Rice Krispie treat instead of a perfectly stretchy, slightly sticky treat. Second, don't skimp on the marshmallows. The additional gooiness the extra marshmallows provide is amazing. It seems like a mountain of marshmallows initially, but I'm promising these are amazing Rice Krispie treats. So hopefully I've sold it to you. This is from Barefeet Kitchen, Mary Yukon. And I'll just tell you, 6 tablespoons of butter, 8 cups of mini marshmallows, 6 cups of Rice Krisp cereal. Melt the butter in the marshmallows, throw in the cereal, 2 cups of marshmallows extra, and then 1.5 cups of shredded coconut sweetened. Unsweetened if you don't want the extra sugar, or I guess probably corn syrup. Okay. And that's it. That's all I have today. That wraps up this week's What's for Dinner. Thanks for joining me. Happy cooking and happy eating from me to you. We'll be back with more What's for Dinner here and there. Stay tuned. We're going to play some music until 4 o'clock, and then we have All Things Considered.